When it's gone that, and then once what he's going to do.
Well, Tom's contribution seems to be the absolute at the heart of the matter, and Greg had the opportunity to comment on it. Seems to me contemporary sociologically interested conscientious Marxists, such as our president at this table, basically have two options. They can either be revisionists and keep the Marxist bottles, but put rather non-Marxist, more permissive and liberal wine into it, which is one way out. And then, of course, the trouble is the stuff is true, but it's not distinctively Marxist. Or one can have, I mean, Thomas Marxism seems to be genuinely mise en bouteille au château.
Thank you.
And then I may mix my metaphors, get one into it, and nowhere one is disagreeing. And that's why I think it's a half matter, because it remains distinctive, it remains arguable about, and one knows what is being said, and one knows why one is disagreeing, and that also seems to me enormously interesting. And there are two or three points at which it's the disagreement seems to be crucial. And it's abstract, but very fundamental. And of course, it's fundamental both for sociological understanding and in terms of current moral and political issues. Now, the crux, of course, is this business about whether you have an theory about an identifiable economic substructure. Now, not only, and of course, Tom holds to this, and I think not necessarily that there's another one, but that one hasn't been established and it's an inadequate theory. And the one point where I think one can put one's finger on a mistake in the actual exposition and the actual argumentation is that there was a kind of slide. He said quite correctly that the social system, I'm not using his words, but I'm trying to be fair to his ideas, the social system must be concerned with the reproducing of the material form of life. Well, indisputably so. Any social system which persists, to say that it persists means that those people or their offspring or their adopted offspring or whatever are still there. The means must be reproduced. Now, this is not in dispute. What is in dispute is what is crucial in the mechanism of achieving this. Now, there, it seems to me that for most of human history, it's at least arguable that the means of coercion and sometimes the means of conceptualization were more important. Of course, the end result has to be to produce a material precondition of life. People have to have something to eat. That's not in dispute. But the way in which people are constrained into doing what has to be done to achieve that, the means by which they are constrained to accept the distribution, the way in which this is done seems to be by no means obvious that this is done by economic mechanisms. And this, it seems to me, where this is at the heart of the matter, and of course it's both a sociological and a moral issue, because for the great problem for Marxists in the political sense, of course, is what went wrong, how was Stalinism possible, and you can only cope with that problem if you think about the problem of power. And the great tragedy as far as contemporary Russians, that they're trying desperately to cope with this, and have, as long as they keep within the permissible terminology, they have no damn idiom in which to do it. This is the damned Marxist heritage, which inhibits them in coping with their own problem. That, by the way, that doesn't directly concern us. The way this mistake occurs seems to me where Marx went wrong. Now it seems the errors of Marx often seems to me that the finger has been put on his wrong errors. The Jewish and the German ancestor of Marx, so to speak, the biblical, the prophetic element and the Hegelian element are very familiar. It seems to me that the host country of Marx, his and mine, must also take some of the blame for his mistakes. This is not so widely appreciated. His errors seem to be distinctively British or Scottish. The whole idea of the economy being predominant, to schematize, is an error which he shares with liberal economics, with the laissez-faire school, with Adam Smith. His errors are something he shares with Adam Smith. The whole idea, and this of course was encouraged by the very peculiar, speaker's trepidation, the presence of historians, the very peculiar thing about the British 18th and 19th century situation was that it looked that the people who had access to the sword, for various reasons, neither wanted to nor could interfere with the people who were producing wealth, who could go on producing wealth, who weren't obliged by their social situation the moment they had it to turn it into swords or into followers. There's something that the whole separation of economy and polity is something very characteristic for early capitalist industrialism. Is not true for most of mankind's history before, is no longer true now, and it's one of the reasons, I mean, the errors of Milton Friedman are roughly the same as, again, as the assumption of something, an autonomous economy. If one were to do this in terms of a concrete example, Alan McCann doesn't seem present, but I imagine he may be watching on the screen. I recently had occasion to read with great deal of care his book on social transformation in a part of Nepal, and the transformation, roughly speaking, from slash and burn to rice growing, from shamanism to Buddhism, shamanism to Hinduism, and so forth. And it doesn't fit what Tom said toward the end. It isn't a case. It's a very radical social change, demographic and other. But it isn't a byproduct in the independent initiating factor in that change is not a change in the means of production in any concrete sense. It's a change in a new combination of the means of coercion, a particular combination of a ruling class providing leadership and ideology with a recruitable would-be peasantry who, in return for military service, is allowed to expand rice production and so on. The whole thing isn't an economic innovation because, as Alan McFarlane describes, the technology involved had always been available. There was nothing new there. There was no technological innovation. It was a combination of political and ideological factors which resulted in very, very fundamental and rapid social change. So it seems to me a case of a... If one takes Marxism in a concrete, specifiable sense, a fascinating counterexample. On this whole business of economy and polity, I remember an article by Moses Finlay in answer to the question, why did Aristotle not write about economics? Why did Chapman write about everything? Why did he miss it out, so to speak? And it seems to me that was the wrong question. The right question is, why did economy, which is not an independent subject, become an independent one in a given period? To begin in reverse. Aristotle was right not to bother about it. The question is, why did Adam Smith think there was such a subject? The one other specific criticism I would make of Tom's reasoning, well, again, when it comes to the business of class, of course one mustn't define class tautologically. Of course one must... When there's domination and inequality, one must be interested in this. But he never mentioned the fact that, after all, the Marxist definition is class in terms of relations to the means of production. If he was using class in that sense, it seemed to be by no means obvious that in cases where stratification and differential social position is important, there are classes. Quite frequently, crucial classes are defined precisely in relationship to the means of production. To the means of coercion. And this is where follow-up check is West African State Book. If you refrain it in that form, or at least leave it open, whether it's coercion or production, which is crucial, then of course there's no disagreement. Sorry, so long, Mr. Chairman.
I'll ask Maurice Godinier to comment.